Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-decision episode of SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Spencer Caron. On July 6, 2020, the Supreme Court affirmed the power of the states to regulate the decisions of presidential electors in Schaffalo v. Washington and its companion case, Colorado Department of State v. Baca. The court held that states may fine or even replace electors who vote for a candidate other than the winner of the statewide popular vote. Joining us today to discuss this decision and its implications is Derek Muller, professor of law at University of Iowa College of Law.
This is a long-awaited decision about faceless electors from the 2016 presidential election. As you may know, when we vote for the president of the United States, we are not actually voting directly for the president in early November. We are voting for a slate of electors who are pledged, usually, to support that presidential candidate. And the Electoral College convenes in late December to cast the formal votes for the president of the United States. And for a long period of time now, really since after the election of George Washington, we've expected that electors sort of align with a particular candidate or a particular party. They've cast a vote consistent with that expectation of the voters. And there have been occasional instances where what we describe as faceless electors, electors who vote in a way contrary to those expectations or the desires of the voters. But they've rarely exercised this sort of independent judgment that maybe the framers, or at least some of the framers, had anticipated they would exercise. So we can fast forward to the 2016 presidential election, where after it becomes apparent that Donald Trump is the candidate who wins the most electoral votes after Election Day, there's some movement among some presidential electors to suggest, well, maybe we could vote for somebody else, or we could get a block of voters who would maybe support a different candidate. And if so, maybe we can either deny Donald Trump the majority of the presidential electors, in which case someone else would win the election, or else at the very least the election could be sent to the House of Representatives so that they could choose a different candidate. And so there were a number of these efforts throughout the country in different states, and two of them sort of came at issue here. One, out of Washington state, there were four electors who cast votes for candidates other than Hillary Clinton, who won the popular vote in the state, and three of those electors voted for Colin Powell for president and various candidates for vice president. They were each fined under Washington state law $1,000 for breaching sort of their pledge. And when they challenged those fines through state court, the Washington State Supreme Court affirmed the fine, saying that they didn't have sort of unfettered discretion. The state had the power to fine them in the event that they chose to vote for someone other than the candidate they were pledged to support. So that was the Washington state sort of side of things in a case called Schaffalo versus Washington. And then there was a second case that came out of Colorado called Baca, Colorado Department of State versus Baca, where Michael Baca was an elector who, again, pledged to support Hillary Clinton, but he showed up at the meeting of the Electoral College and attempted to vote for John Kasich for president instead of Hillary Clinton. And when he attempted to do so, he was deemed to have vacated his office. He was then replaced by the electors with another elector who voted for Hillary Clinton, and then those votes were sent along to Congress, which counted those votes. So when Baca challenged his, his replacement, it went up through the district court in Colorado, and the 10th Circuit found that Colorado's law was unconstitutional, that Colorado could not enforce this requirement that electors have the discretion to be able to vote for whomever they desire, and the state can't replace him. So there was a sort of difference in opinion between the Washington State Supreme Court and the 10th Circuit, and that's when it came to the Supreme Court in these pair of cases. So there's a little bit of a quirk that happened. These cases were originally consolidated to be heard together, but Justice Sotomayor later in the process realized that she had a personal friendship with one of the parties in the Colorado case, so she was dropped out of that case. And so all nine justices heard Schiaffalo, and then only eight formally heard Baca. So the Supreme Court issued its decision today, and the approach it took was one that a lot of people had speculated, which is that the principal opinion in Schiaffalo, which involves all nine justices, was sort of one that was issued, and then there was a very brief per curiam opinion in Baca with Justice Sotomayor recused, saying, go back and see Schiaffalo for the same reasoning. So for the most part, these cases are decided together, except for this sort of one technical distinction that happened here. So in Schiaffalo, the decision of the court is unanimous, or at least the result is unanimous. Eight justices joined in Justice Kagan's majority opinion, and Justice Clarence Thomas wrote a separate concurring opinion, concurring in the judgment, which Justice Gorsuch joined in part. But all nine justices agreed that states do have the power to fine electors who cast votes contrary to the expectations of the voters, and they do have the power to replace faithless electors, too. So Justice Kagan's opinion really heavily relies first on a case called Ray versus Blair, which was a 1952 decision out of Alabama involving whether states could even create this pledge in the first place. Alabama had a rogue elector, if you will, in 1948, and they wanted to try to provide some extra certainty. And they said, well, let's require electors to take this pledge. There was no enforcement mechanism in place, just sort of a requirement that you take the pledge. And the court there said, you know, for a long time, electors have been sort of exercising not their independent judgment, but essentially acting on behalf of the voters who have selected them to essentially act as their agents. And so requiring them to take a pledge is something that the Constitution doesn't forbid states from doing. So states could require electors to take a pledge. Now, the enforceability of that pledge was something that was in dispute until this case, and the court sort of, again, relies on this longstanding practices kind of understanding that really electors have been very consistently faithful in terms of the votes they cast. When we think about longstanding, if you will, liquidation of precedent over an extended period of time, the court relies on things like the resets appointments challenges and NLRB versus Noel Canning points out, you know, these are sort of longstanding expectations in our constitutional structure. And the fact that we've for a long time had electors who are expected to vote in a particular way, Ray versus Blair says we can require them to take a pledge. Now in Schiaffalo, it says, you know, states can fine them or states can replace them in the event that they choose to do something else. And the court's, you know, majority opinion is really deferential to the states because you know, there's a line Justice Kagan uses where she says the Constitution is bare bones about electors, right? And if the Constitution doesn't have very much, it has this sort of brief mention of appointment and process and you know, how we count votes and how we transmit lists to Congress. Without much else there, the Constitution is fairly silent, and if that's the case for the majority, that means you know, broad discretion given to the states to control the manner of appointing presidential electors. That can include fining faithless electors or replacing them. And the electors' argument when they raise this claim is say, look, the Constitution includes these phrases like elector and ballot and vote. And when you see words like this in the Constitution, these are words that you know suggest a kind of independent choice, right? The opportunity to exercise judgment. Ballots are supposed to be private or secret. They're written down as opposed to an oral vote. Votes are supposed to be something that you have the decision to choose among things, right? So this language the electors had argued, you know, Schiaffalo and Baca said, this gives us sort of deference to make the decisions we want. But Justice Kagan was sort of, you know, less than impressed with this line of reasoning, saying, look, they don't always mean independent choice. You know, if a person says, you know, I always vote the way my pastor or my union boss or my spouse tells me, me to, and I just always do that. Yeah, I guess I'm not really exercising independent judgment anymore, but I'm still voting. I'm still casting a ballot in these cases, right? So the court was not as persuaded that these words in the Constitution actually required independent choice. And this was confirmed, she pointed out, by the 12th Amendment. So in the original Constitution, the electors were supposed to meet and they were supposed to vote for two candidates. Whoever got the most votes became president. Whoever got the second most votes became vice president. And this worked well when everyone wanted George Washington as president. And then there were a bunch of sort of scattered votes elsewhere. But the system broke down in a couple of ways. And in 1796, where, you know, John Adams had his own sort of vice presidential candidate, they were running kind of as a ticket. But they realize your electors can't all vote for the same two people or else it's a tie and the election gets sent to the House. But then it turns out that too many people voted for someone as their second choice other than Adams' preferred vice presidential candidate. And so Adams' enemy, Thomas Jefferson, is the runner-up and becomes the vice president in that 1796 election. And then in 1800, everyone votes for Thomas Jefferson, or all the Jeffersonians vote for Thomas Jefferson for president and Aaron Burr for vice president. They tie and it goes to the House of Representatives, where they have to go to 36, you know, attempts to vote to figure out whether or not to figure out who the winner is going to be before it gets to be Jefferson. So these are two complicated systems and processes, but they also sort of suggest at this point, Justice Kagan points out, there's an expectation that electors are going to vote for the party candidate. And so when the 12th Amendment is enacted in 1804, to allow candidates to or electors to vote for a president and a separate vice president on distinct ballots, there's this implication within there that they're also going to be expected to sort of follow through with the decision-making processes in terms of what a candidate wants or what the popular vote has expected or demanded, right? So the amendment advanced this understanding, she explained, from the nation's first election. So whatever the Federalist Papers might have thought about the Electoral College, the 12th Amendment has updated and sort of altered the expectations at that point. And the electors had a challenge to say, Congress has counted faithless electors before. We can point to all these faithless electors. And on the one hand, Justice Kagan says, well, yeah, they have. But there are instances where, a candidate dies and they vote for somebody else. And so a lot of these aren't necessarily what we might describe as faithless. But she also says, the fact that Congress has deferred to state decisions on faithless electors doesn't mean that we have to reject the fact that a state has penalized electors. So, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If Congress can count faithless electors, maybe Congress can also choose to reject the votes of faithless electors when the state has done so. And there are a couple of footnotes in my mind that were of note also in the opinion. So one is the state emphasizes, look, when you appoint, or the court says when the state appoints electors, it has to be consistent with other provisions of the Constitution. So there are still some limits on what they can do. They can't violate equal protection, for instance. So if a state were to, have a racially exclusionary elector selection system, that would probably run afoul of the Constitution. And another is that if states appoint a condition on appointments that impose new requirements on presidential candidates, the condition may conflict with the Presidential Qualifications Clause. And this is a suggestion that comes out of a case involving term limits in the 1990s for Congress, an open question about whether or not states can add qualifications to presidential candidates, including, in recent years, people have talked about requiring candidates to disclose their tax returns as a condition of appearing on the ballot. And the suggestion here from the court in this footnote is that it would call into question such laws that would add qualifications to candidates seeking the office of president. So that's one interesting footnote. Another was, footnote 8 of the opinion, that the court notes, well, the electors point out what happens if a candidate dies between Election Day and the meeting of the Electoral College. Don't states have to exercise independent judgment? And some states actually have an express proviso that allows for electors to exercise their independent judgment if the candidate dies. Justice Kagan points out this is not before us. We doubt states would necessarily enforce it. Who knows what will happen? My view, there's an additional question sort of about the 20th Amendment, because we sort of now might presume that even if you were to vote for an ineligible president or a dead president by inauguration day, the vice president becomes president. So there's sort of this provision to sort of recognize that death can be its own sort of interesting wrinkle to consider when it comes to presidential electors. But, again, it was something that the court didn't have to consider today. And then Justice Thomas, so he wrote a separate opinion concurring in the judgment. And part one of his opinion sort of emphasized, look, the court's not really sort of being consistent with how it approaches sort of constitutional text or the mechanism of the state. But really, he focuses also in an opinion joined by Justice Gorsuch in part two of the opinion about the 10th Amendment. And this is an argument that he had raised, and he lost this case in 1995 called Term Limits versus Thornton. And he wrote an opinion on behalf of four justices saying, if the Constitution doesn't prohibit states from doing things, then the 10th Amendment reserves those decisions to the state. And in the 90s, he said that means that states have the power to add qualifications or at least add a term limit requirement to members of Congress. And here again, he emphasizes the 10th Amendment, although not with four justices in dissent, just Justice Gorsuch joining him to say, you know, the Constitution is really silent in terms of the power to control elections. And as opposed to the majority, which just says this silence means states have power, we should be looking instead to the 10th Amendment. And if it's the 10th Amendment, the 10th Amendment means the states have this reserved power. So when we're thinking about where the state's authority comes from, it doesn't come from longstanding practices or sort of a broad consensus of historical understanding. It really ought to come out of the 10th Amendment's power. But again, that decision, you know, only joined by Justice Gorsuch, it received a little bit of attention at oral argument. I was intrigued to see if Justice Kavanaugh, for instance, was going to join that, but he didn't. In short, so all nine justices agreed with the outcome. States can fine faithless electors. They can replace faithless electors. So what that means for today is, you know, all of the existing laws on the books, which, you know, there's a variety of laws on the books. Some laws, you know, require a pledge with no enforcement. Some states have an enforcement mechanism, and a number of states don't have any sort of rule at all. You know, it's just kind of states can or electors can exercise their independent judgment. And if they do so, there's no penalty, no fine, nothing like that. What I anticipate, so we should expect the status quo, if you will, for the 2020 election. Faithless electors will have a much more difficult time in those jurisdictions where there is a penalty mechanism in place. You know, so it would be difficult to rebel if that's like in 2016. But more to the point, I would anticipate maybe not so many by 2020 because, you know, we've got a closing window by November, but certainly by the 2024 election, I expect state legislatures to begin instituting new statutes in earnest to control and bind presidential electors. I think the activities of 2016 highlighted the sort of weakness in the system for many. Voters don't expect when they vote for Hillary Clinton, they don't expect their elector to then show up on the meeting of the Electoral College and vote for Colin Powell or John Kasich, right? So my anticipation is states will begin to enact new statutes that will bind presidential elector discretion, probably more that will replace them rather than just fine them. But, you know, that remains an open question, but certainly a green light to legislatures to sort of alter how their presidential electors are chosen.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.